Food Safety Matters presenting sponsor is Safety Chain Software, the leading innovator of real-time food safety and quality management solutions, helping food and beverage companies reduce risks, control costs, and ensure everyday compliance. With Safety Chain, companies throughout the food supply chain get the real-time data intelligence needed to improve everyday decision-making, operational performance, and the bottom line. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Safety Matters, the podcast for food safety professionals. I'm Stacey Atchison, publisher of Food Safety Magazine, and I'm here with Barbara Van Rentterham, our editorial director. And as you may have detected already, as we record this episode, we're in Chicago attending the Process Expo. We're actually in our booth before the show opens, preparing for a busy day. Lots of other people are preparing for their busy day. Barbara will be moderating a panel in the Food Safety Theater, sponsored by Friends at the Food Safety Summit. It seems like food safety has really become a focus at this conference, which is a great development. And I think this is due to the impact of implementing the Food Safety Modernization Act. Food safety is playing a more prominent role in all aspects of manufacturing and the overall food supply chain. We explored this and more when we caught up with Adrian Cooper from the Food Safety Summit here at Process Expo. Okay, so as I said, we're sitting down with Adrian Cooper, Senior Event Manager for the Food Safety Summit, which is produced by BMP Media. Thanks for fitting us into your really busy schedule, Adrian.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, you know, we love partnering with you guys, so it's fun to sit down and have you on our podcast. So welcome to Food Safety Matters.
Thank you.
So we were talking about the fact that, we mentioned earlier that the Food Safety Summit is presenting the Food Safety Theater here at Process Expo that's provided a whole set of programming, like daily programming for the conference this year on specifically addressing food safety. And Process Expo has covered food safety in the past, you know, obviously, but this is really a lot more, and it seems like it's taking a much more prominent role in this year's conference. Can you talk about maybe how that came to be and, you know, why that was felt to be so important this year?
Sure. Right. The FPSA has covered, Process Expo has covered food safety in the past, but they reached out to us and let us know that they really wanted it to be a focus this year and asked us to work with them on helping them to develop some sessions that would run in the Food Safety Theater here on the show floor. And we, of course, said, yes, we would love to take part and help develop that education, because the Food Safety Summit has a wonderful educational advisory board full of experts in food safety. And so we really had that resource to be able to help put together that kind of education here on the floor with them.
Would you say, what's the response been? Have they, how many sessions did you guys do?
We did two sessions a day, okay. So this is the third day today, and we've had two sessions take place. A few other sessions were produced by Process Expo in that theater, but the Food Safety Summit produced two sessions each day here on the floor. And they've all been really well attended. We had one just today that was moderated by your very own editorial director. That was standing room only. So
really?
they've been very well received, and people have come by our booth and let us know how much they really enjoy the session. So I think the content's been really, really well received by the attendees.
Great. Have you gotten any feedback as far as the interest in any particular topics that people were interested in, or what? I mean, I know the one that Barbara said, that was, I guess, FSMA.
She presented on FSMA. Updates and continuing, you know, the continuing way that those regulations will continue to evolve. That's always going to be, it has been and will continue to be a focus here and at the Food Safety Summit, because those regulations affect everybody in the industry, every segment in the industry. So those topics are of continued interest. We had sessions on HACCP. People are really still interested in and in need of the certification and training that goes along with FSMA. So those sessions were well attended.
Anything on hygienic design or anything like that? Did you guys get into that?
Oh, yes, our friends at OSI presented on hygienic equipment design. Sean Stevens with the Food Industry Council did a great session on the first day where he talked about regulations and the legal implications, you know, that go along with foodborne illness outbreaks and how that can affect your company and how to be prepared. So, yeah.
I really like hearing that they were, so well attended and SRO. That's really, we've just noticed just a real increase of awareness and interest at this year's conference that's been, well, you know, encouraging. So when you look, are you going to be working with them again for the next Process Expo? Do you think that's going to continue, or is that has that been hammered out yet?
It has not been hammered out yet, but we absolutely want to continue that relationship. We really embrace and, you know, encourage other industry events to reach out to us if they want to work with us to really put a focus on food safety and food safety education. We, you know, like I said before, we have access to a lot of expertise and really wonderful speakers and industry folks on our educational advisory board. We've worked with other industry events like PAC Expo in the past. We hosted our Food Safety Summit Resource Center there for many years. So it's definitely something that we want to continue to do.
Well, and the next the thing on the horizon next up is the Food Safety Summit in May of next year, and that's your 20th anniversary?
Yes, we're very excited to be celebrating our 20th year. We're in May of 2018 at Rosemont, and our focus for this year is managing food safety through the supply chain. So certainly the attendees here at Process Expo, food processors, food manufacturers, are a huge portion of you know, the contingent of attendees that we have at the Food Safety Summit, but all segments of the industry are represented there. And we really want to talk about the importance of food safety throughout the entire supply chain, representing every segment of.
Well, I know you've been working really hard on engaging subject matter experts on that since IAFP, since the International Association of Food Production meeting in Tampa. You had people there at 7 o'clock in the morning. Talk about dedicated professionals coming in to give their advice to make sure that you guys are getting a top-notch program for next year.
Oh yeah, I mean, we start planning our programming the day after the Food Safety Summit ends, and that's really the first big meeting where we get a lot of these industry experts together, and they are so generous with their time and they are so passionate about what they do that, they really help us to put together a really phenomenal program, and we're really excited about 2018.
Well, we're excited too, and we're looking forward to being, to partnering with you guys again. We love working with you and we love supporting the summit, and it's been great to see, to have that relationship continue here at Process Expo, and we look forward to the next time that we see you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks,
we love
Adrian.
Seeing you at these shows, and we can't wait to see you again in 2018.
Okay. Till then. Today, we've got the great pleasure of bringing you our interview with Mike Taylor, who until last year was Deputy Commissioner for Foods and Veterinary Medicine at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, where, among other things, he led the overhaul of FDA's food safety program with the introduction and implementation of the Food Safety Modernization Act. Mike is currently a senior fellow at the Meridian Institute, and he and Barbara cover a lot of interesting topics, so stay tuned. That will be up shortly.
So as we find ourselves in Chicago, which has a long history in the meatpacking industry, it seemed fitting to bring up the passage of the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906, which came into being the same day as the Federal Meat Inspection Act, which was referenced by Mike Taylor on today's podcast. So another fun fact from Food Safety Magazine, The Jungle, which was written by Upton Sinclair, helped influence the passage of the Pure Food and Drug Act. Even though that was a work of fiction, scholars report that Sinclair accurately portrayed the important issue of unsanitary meat processing. So it's interesting to be in Chicago and see how far at least meat processing has come since that time. So it is an interesting read for those of you who have never picked up that book.
Now we're going to check in on a few news items that caught our attention since the last episode. Starting with the fact that earlier this month, FDA announced new labels for peanut-containing foods. The new labels note that some peanut-containing foods are suitable for infants and may even reduce the risk of them developing an allergy. A clinical trial found that introducing foods containing smooth peanut butter to infants who were at high risk of peanut allergy dramatically reduced their risk of developing it in childhood. The new label will read, "For most infants with severe eczema and or egg allergy who are already eating solid foods, introducing foods containing ground peanuts between 4 and 10 months of age and continuing consumption may reduce the risk of developing peanut allergy by 5 years of age." Peanut allergy is one of the most common food allergies in the United States, and rates of that allergy have doubled between 1997 and 2008.
So Steve Taylor, when we talked to him in episode 4, mentioned that introducing peanut-containing foods to infants is already happening in the rest of the world, and it's great that the U.S. has finally jumped on that bandwagon. So if you're interested in these developments, we encourage you to go back and listen to Steve talk about that. Particularly in the Middle East, they've been doing that for a long time, and they don't have near the rates of peanut allergy that we do in the States.
So it seems like this episode is sort of, you know, all things Food Safety Modernization Act. It's heavy on that. Produce safety rule is now final. The rule establishes science-based standards for safe growing, harvesting, packing, and holding of fruits and vegetables for human consumption. Compliance dates for the rule vary based on the size of the business in terms of sales, as well as certain aspects of the rule that may be applicable to farms. Some farms will begin to see compliance dates within the year.
Yeah, it's interesting that if you're a farm that also does processing, you will have to comply with the preventive controls rule. But we have a lot of resources on our site as well as on FDA's site to kind of guide you through that process to see what applies to your particular business.
Yeah, we'll be giving you all those links, as many as we can fit into our show notes. So also related to the produce rule, FDA delayed the water testing compliance portion of the rule for 2 years. This was in recognition of the need for expanded efforts to educate growers and state officials on the new produce safety requirements. And towards that end, the agency will continue its focus on training, guidance development, and outreach over the next year. For agricultural water compliance dates, FDA issued a proposed rule that would extend the compliance dates for agricultural water requirements by an additional 2 to 4 years for produce other than sprouts. This really allows FDA to take another look at the water standards to ensure that they are feasible for farmers in all regions of the country and still protect public health. FDA plans to talk with farmers, state regulatory partners, and others about how water is used in agriculture, and that outreach will include an agriculture water summit early next year. There's a link in the show notes to that guidance from FDA. We're also going to give you a link to an article from our August-September issue, which really goes into great detail. It's called Fixing FSMA's Ag Water Requirements, and it's written by a great collaboration between Jennifer McIntyre from United Fresh Produce and Jim Gorney of the Produce Marketing Association. So they go into great detail on the issues surrounding agriculture water in FSMA's produce rule.
I have nothing more to add. They say it all in that article.
So check out that link. All right. So you can find all these stories and much, much more at foodsafetymagazine.com. To keep up with news and content as it breaks, follow us on Twitter at foodsafetymag. Now it's time for Barbara's interview with Mike Taylor. Mike is a senior fellow at the Meridian Institute and an advisor to the Food and Society Program at the Aspen Institute. His primary interests are food safety globally and food security in Africa and other developing regions. Until June 1, 2016, Mr. Taylor was Deputy Commissioner for Foods and Veterinary Medicine at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. He led the comprehensive overhaul of FDA's food safety program, Congress mandated in the Food Safety Modernization Act of 2011, and oversaw all of FDA's food-related activities, including its nutrition labeling, food additive, dietary supplement, and animal drug programs. Mr. Taylor served previously at FDA as staff attorney and as deputy commissioner for policy from 91 to 94, and at USDA as administrator for the Food Safety and Inspection Service and acting undersecretary for food safety from 94 to 96. Prior to joining FDA in July of 2009, he spent nearly a decade in academia conducting food safety, food security, and public health policy research, most recently at George Washington University School of Public Health. He also served during that time as a senior fellow at the Partnership to Cut Hunger and Poverty in Africa, where he conducted research on U.S. policies affecting agricultural development and food security in Africa. In the private sector, Mr. Taylor founded the food and drug practice and was a partner in the law firm of King & Spalding. He was vice president for public policy at Monsanto and served on the boards of the Alliance to End Hunger and Resolve, Inc. He is currently a board member of Stop Foodborne Illness and Clear Labs. He's a graduate of Davidson College and the University of Virginia School of Law.
Another mouthful of a bio there, Stacy.
I'm just going to collapse now. Mike's way too accomplished.
Well, it was really great talking to him, and he's more relaxed than I've ever heard him. So being a little bit more distant from public health has certainly lessened his stress load. It is interesting that life has really come full circle for him in terms of his work in Africa, and we will be bringing you, our audience, more developments with Mike. He promised that in the podcast. I also hope that Mike is getting to more Washington Nationals games. He wanted to do that too. So,
I think they're drag racing on the floor now.
I don't know. I like that golf cart idea.
Yeah. All right. So after a quick break, we're going to hear that interview. Safety Chain Solutions provide the program visibility, data intelligence, and tools needed to more effectively manage food safety and quality operations. With Safety Chain's suite of solutions, supplier compliance, food safety and quality, CIP optimization, and material loss, customers are able to ensure everyday program compliance, mitigate risks, and better protect their bottom line and brand. Visit safetychain.com to learn about how Safety Chain can help your company improve performance for better results.
Well, hi, Mike. It's great to have you on our podcast today.
Hi, Barbara. Great to join you.
Well, let's get started. I'm sure that all of our listeners are eager to hear what you've been up to since you left FDA a little over a year ago, but it just seems wrong not to pay tribute to your incredible tenure as a public servant. So not long after you joined USDA Food Safety and Inspection Service, you were advocating for new public health goals for the agency that eventually culminated in HACCP for meat and poultry and for E. coli 0157H7 being labeled an adulterant. So even in the face of strong opposition, you managed to accomplish these goals. So I'm interested in hearing what motivated you then and in your subsequent work at FDA to push for comprehensive changes in food safety regulations.
That is a story. I joined FSIS following the Jack in the Box outbreak. I'd been at the Food and Drug Administration as Deputy Commissioner for Policy. I'd done some food safety work, but working across the agency broadly. But I was asked to come over and be administrator of FSIS at a time when the community knew that there needed to be change in the meat and poultry inspection program. Because if you'll remember, at the time that happened, the head of the agency at the time had to stand up and say that the system worked as intended. It just wasn't intended to deal with microbial pathogens in raw meat product. Consumers at that time, so the policy of USDA said, were expected to cook their meat. This was unacceptable to consumers, unacceptable really to everybody in light of the tragedy of the Jack in the Box event. So, and so the question was, how do you do that in a way that will make a real impact on food safety? There was support for HACCP, but what was really missing in the thinking around HACCP at that time was that that there needed to be really accountability, direct accountability for dealing with the microbial pathogens. not just in a generic way, but in a specific way. E. coli 015787, of course, was the source of the illnesses in Jack in the Box, and it just was evident coming into the agency right off the bat that there needed to be accountability immediately for controlling that pathogen, and that was the basis for the decision we made to deem E. coli 015787 an adulterant and thus illegal in raw ground beef in particular. But then we took that principle of accountability for pathogens and built it into the HACCP rulemaking and added salmonella pathogen reduction standards and so forth. This was something that did create some resistance initially in the meat industry. It was something that was very strongly supported by the administration at the time. I actually felt very empowered to do what we thought was the right thing to do to make a difference in building prevention and accountability into the meat and poultry inspection program. And so we did go through that two-year rulemaking process and get the HACCP rules in place with salmonella pathogen reduction performance standard. A lot has happened since then off of that experience beyond regulation. And I think we're in a whole new world now in a very positive way. But that was a seminal event, the Jack in the Box event, and the response, not just of government through what we did at FSIS, but the food industry, the consumer community. It really was a galvanizing event in food safety history for sure.
Right. Now, I know when you started working on FSMA and you would tour the country talking with processors and farmers and anyone who wanted to have input on the new regulations, there seemed to be some resistance and disparate ideas about what was important. Do you think industry has progressed in its view of regulations as tools for ensuring the safety of the food supply?
I would say yes, tremendously. If you compare the FSMA experience with the circumstances leading up to Jack in the Box and in the immediate response to Jack in the Box, where there was pushback to certain kinds of regulatory accountability, FSMA happened because the food industry realized that it was time to build prevention into the overall food safety program of the government, not just HACCP at USDA and seafood HACCP at FDA, but to make modern preventive controls the norm across all commodities and to really strengthen verification that these preventive measures were being implemented. So it's a night and day difference because industry pushed for FSMA implementation, FSMA's enactment congressionally, the legislation itself. They engaged and generally supported the rulemaking process and wanted it to come to completion, and the industry supported funding for FSMA implementation. The work that we did traveling during the rulemaking, you know, was work that was very necessary when you sort of go beyond the legislation to really try to reduce that to practice through regulations that would work across the diversity of the food supply, as I said many times as we went about. We had to have a set of rules that would work across the diversity of the food system. And that's what all that travel was about. And yeah, there were issues and there were lots of discussion and lots of input that we had to take into account, and differing views across the private sector and differences between FDA and the private sector on some issues. And so, yeah, that was a necessary part of the process, but it wasn't in any way a resistance to the need to elevate regulatory standards. It was figuring out how to do it in an effective but workable way.
Now, did that impact the different exemptions for the rules or how soon the companies would need to implement them?
Well, the whole process of that rulemaking, the several different, a number of different regulations we did, was a learning process at every level, having to do with both the substantive content of, you know, how you implement preventive controls through regulation, to how you set up the foreign supplier verification program, the produce safety standards domestically and internationally, I mean, being huge new areas of work. It was a learning experience throughout, and that included learning about how to deal with some of the implementation challenges of the very small producers. And right. Some of those exemptions were built into the legislation. FDA made some decisions about implementation dates and certain exemptions that we thought were practical to make the system work. And it was part of that dialogue. I you know, you're never going to get 1,000% right in doing something this complex. And,
right.
But I think, again, the agency, the people who did the rulemaking, the day in, day out slogging of getting those regs done, I think listened and
right.
and really worked to do it, get as close to the right answer as we possibly could.
Right. It had to be quite a challenge to be able to distill all the comments and just what you were learning as you were traveling around, to distill all of that information into a comprehensive set of rules.
Yeah, I just can't say enough about the people at FDA who did that. And, you know, it was the scientists, the regulatory policy people, the lawyers, just incredible effort by many, many, many people to get that done. And what really was, when you consider the magnitude of the complexity of the effort, was in a relatively short period of time. And people were extremely resilient, and just I can't say enough about them.
You know, when I look back over your career in preparing for our conversation today, you did take a break from government for over 10 years, but then found your way back. So what was it that called you back into public service?
Well, you know, I started out at FDA right out of law school, and so I began my career really focused on public service as something that appealed to me. And I, in that first experience as a staff lawyer, fell in love with FDA and its mission, and the whole environment there was something that attracted me. So when I was in academia and research, you know, think tanks and university settings for those 10 years, I had no long-term vision to return to FDA, but I'd been doing some work on how to do risk-based resource allocation in the food safety system, working with a group of other researchers, and had a continuing interest in sort of system-level change, and then got, you know, in an academic kibitzing way, got drawn into some of the FSMA early discussions about the legislation, and then started looking at some of the institutional issues about how you would implement a modern risk-based system, including organizational issues, and both within FDA and across the federal system. So I was writing about that. And so basically, when Peggy Hamburg reached out and asked me to think about coming back, it was, you know, it was easy for me to think about it. And you know, she created an opportunity to create the Office of Foods and Veterinary Medicine and to do some organizational change within FDA, but also we were anticipating the enactment of FSMA and the opportunity to implement something that I think we all knew was really going to be a big deal, moving in the right direction on food safety. That, you know, it was not a hard decision. It was something kind of natural,
right,
in the evolution of my career.
It sounds like a perfect fit. Now, you're known to have advocated for a single food agency, and as well as for HACCP for all foods. Are these still important goals that the entire industry should be moving forward in?
Well, HACCP, or, you know, preventive controls, as FSMA labels it, I mean, that's where we're going. The die is cast. So single food agency is, to me, not a sort of an end or an outcome that's important in its own right, independent of what it is we're trying to do in our food safety system. The issue is, given scarcity of resources, how do you arrive at a federal food safety system that is making best use of all available resources to reduce the risk of illness, to verify that standards are being met? And we now have, between USDA and FDA, very disparate statutory frameworks, congressional mandates, and we've got FSMA for FDA and 80% of the food supply, and we've got the meat and poultry inspection laws that conceptually date back to 1906 for slaughter and the right. 50s and 60s for processing. And there are statutory mandates that are out of date badly in terms of how they use federal resources, food safety resources, and also in limitations that are placed on USDA's authority to do a truly farm-to-table risk-based prevention system. So the first question is, how do you get a statutory framework that within which resources can be optimally used. And if Congress decided that it wanted to have a federal food safety system that made best use of all available resources and legislated to make that possible, then you get to the question of, would it be helpful in implementing that to have a single agency? And I think with that, the right statutory and legislative reform and commitments from a budget and resource management standpoint to make best use of all available resources, then, yeah, the way to do that is through a single agency where there's clear accountability for how all the resources are managed. But I don't think that we should move towards that sort of organizational change until the statutes have been fixed, until you have the right coherent federal risk-based prevention, you know, framework that empowers and directs the people leading the program to apply the resources in the most appropriate way across the whole system, farm to table.
Yeah, I think only in a case like that would you be able to merge the programs if they were starting from a fairly even plane.
Yeah, I mean, the statutory frameworks and as a result, the sort of organizational cultures of the two agencies are so different. Just simply merging them together under one roof would be very costly and very disruptive, and would not yield benefits significantly, because you'd still have U.S., you know, the meat and poultry program right, operating under a different antiquated set of laws. So again, just the organizational issues need to follow the policy decision, the policy framework, and legislative decisions about what we want the federal food safety system to be in terms of mainly resource utilization and again, modernizing of USDA's, the FSIS regulatory toolkit.
So many of the rules that are in place today were born out of reactions to outbreaks, whether it was HACCP for meat and poultry after Jack in the Box, or the beginnings of the food protection plan in response to spinach and other outbreaks. Do you think we finally turn the corner that with FSMA primarily, that we can do a lot more prevention and we won't have to keep resetting after a massive outbreak?
Yeah. I think that's a great question, and I think we are turning a corner in terms of what will drive future progress on food safety. We're still going to have outbreaks, but I think that we're moving in a direction where hopefully we'll have fewer outbreaks and certainly smaller outbreaks. You know, all the tools of whole genome sequencing and the tools that we've got to detect outbreaks more rapidly are I think going to reduce the frequency of these large outbreaks that are so disruptive and become crises that catalyze change.
Right.
I hope that's the case. And one of the positive features of FSMA, of course, is that it builds a continuous improvement obligation into the regulatory framework, one that is based on evolving science, because it sets the standard, broadly speaking, for what constitutes appropriate preventive controls on the basis of what a knowledgeable expert would do based upon current science. And then it says you're supposed to revisit your plan periodically based on changes in science. So science and technology, as they continue to evolve, whether it's in areas like whole genome sequencing or other areas related to both prevention and verification, that's what I envision will be driving progress going forward, and hopefully that will be the case more so than reacting, you know, to major crises. And you know, most importantly, because we don't want these big outbreaks that make, you know, so many people sick and
right,
put such a burden, on the community in so many different ways. So yeah, I'm you know, optimistic that we are turning a corner, and that there will be less crisis and more continuous improvement based upon our improving ability through technology and other means to make food safer.
Well, in my former life as a bench scientist, that makes me very happy that science is playing a front and center role in all of this. So if we fast forward a little bit, it seemed like that that your life has really come full circle. When you were a senior fellow at the Partnership to Cut Hunger and Poverty in Africa, you conducted research affecting agricultural development and food security in Africa. And once again, you're involved in African food security and in other developing regions. So what initially triggered your interest in food security?
Well, that's an interesting question because it springs off of the an episode of my career that has had notoriety of over the years, which was the 16 months I spent at Monsanto back in sort of late 98 to early 2000. And, you know, where I was in sort of an internal think tank role and supposedly looking at issues that sort of long-term and issues that would affect the success of a life sciences company based on a genomics platform. So the CEO had this vision of looking at agriculture, nutrition, and pharmaceuticals based on gene technology. And so that seemed pretty interesting to me. But it happened at a time when the biotech acceptance issue was hitting the fan in Europe. So I spent a lot of time on that. But I was also asked to look at possible applications of the technology in a food security developing country setting. And I had some exposure, not a lot, but some exposure to the agricultural challenges in Africa and other developing places and how that links to food security and you know, how do you harness whatever tools are available to address those agricultural production and food security interests. So that was really what got me interested. When I decided that Monsanto was not the place for me, I decided I wanted to pursue this interest in food security in a nonprofit research setting. So I went to Resources for the Future, which is a Washington-based think tank, and then joined, you know, began to do work in that arena, working with the Partnership to Cut Hunger and Poverty in Africa, as you mentioned. And so, yeah, it was a great period for me because I got a chance to travel in Africa and look at the food system there broadly. A lot of the work had to do with advocating for more and better agricultural development assistance for Africa, aimed at food security and the development benefits of a successful agricultural system in Africa. So that was how I got interested in Africa and the African food system originally.
Now, with the work that you're doing today, what do you see as the major challenges for building food safety capacity abroad?
Yeah. So coming out of FDA, I did want to stay involved in food safety, and I was drawn to Africa because of the potential there, but also the huge challenges that they've got broadly in their food system and food safety because of the, you know, what I'd learned about the international impacts of FSMA and the whole global movement around food safety modernization. That was the obvious lens through which now to look at the African food system, and it's an exciting time, really. I'm going to get to your question about the challenges, but I think the starting point is what was striking to me was just seeing how much food safety had emerged in Africa in the 7 years that I'd been away from focusing on Africa at all as an issue that the African governments, business community are focusing on because of impact on their consumers, but also their market access, both within the continent and outside the continent. And the donor community, the international development agencies, had begun to do lots of work on food safety capacity building, not lots compared to what's going on the health side or in other areas of basic food security. So there's a tremendous opportunity that the community is seeing to really enhance the way we invest in food safety capacity building, and, you know, both for food safety public health reasons and also for trade and development reasons. I mean, the challenge is that and I should say challenges plural are. I mean, but really start with just the incredible complexity and diversity of Africa, and the for one thing, but also the fact that, as is well known, you know, the so much of the African food system is simply not at a state of development technologically and economically that other in that we're fortunate to have in the United States and Europe and other parts of the world, and that includes both private sector and public sector capacity. So it's we're starting from behind in a way, and when you look at the challenge of meeting modern prevention oriented food safety standards, what the project I'm actually spending most of my time on is one that is looking at that complexity and starting point of where the African food safety system is, but also the complexity, and this is really the focus of a project I'm doing with a group at the World Bank, is on the complexity of the donor community effort to address these very diverse food safety needs in Africa. There are many, many UN agencies, development banks, bilateral development agencies globally that are active in Africa, but there's also a wide recognition that it's not terribly coordinated. It tends to be like so much of development assistance. It tends to be donor driven, to some extent, more than really driven by the strategies and agendas of the partner countries in Africa. So what we're really focusing on is how to look at that whole system of efforts to strengthen food safety in Africa with donor contribution resources and expertise and industry engagement. How do you put all that together into a more coherent way to use the still relatively modest resources that are going into this in the scheme of things, but with all the interest and energy, how do you really apply that in the most impactful ways? And this is a topic we could talk about for a long time, and I'd be happy to. But I'm based on, I've made a few trips there in the last year. It's just the opportunity is huge, and the level of interest in both the global food industry and the Africa-based industry is really strong, and the governments are, in at least, a number of cases, the African Union, these are folks who are really getting it and wanting to make the system better. So lots of opportunity there.
A few years ago, I was speaking with an African food scientist about the food insecurity issues in his country and throughout Africa. And I tend, typical scientists drill down to the lowest common denominator. And I said, well, if genetically modified vegetables can provide more nutrition to the people of Africa and help with the food insecurity, why aren't these crops available widely? And his reply was that then these countries would not be able to export to Europe. And for the first time, it really struck me the close ties between, what a government has to do for their economic survival and, to deal with the food insecurity of their own country. So I was wondering if you see that when you're over in Africa playing a role.
Well, I think we've all seen it over the last decade or more with respect to biotech in particular, because due to the history of the way that the introduction of that technology was managed by the biotech companies, including the one I worked for, but also by the U.S. government, there was such an aggressive take it or you must take this technology sort of approach, and that was really what created the conflict with Europe, and Africa, very oriented towards Europe, was influenced by the distrust that was developed in the European population about the technology, a population that has its own different values about food anyway compared to the U.S. And so we did have a situation in which sort of social differences and lack of trust generated by behaviors that I think were not the best by both the companies and the U.S. government back then, really have stymied the ability for both private sector and public sector in places like Africa to make choices that are more science driven and less driven by the sort of distrust and so forth that have been generated on that issue. So that's a problem. I don't think that's like the biggest problem that African food security has, because, you know, there's so many ways in which the productivity of agriculture is affected and can be improved. And, you know, I ideally where drought resistant seeds, however produce, can be important, or disease resistant, those right. ideally should be available. But again, it's only going to work if these are chosen by the people in governments, you know, in industry, in the community, consumer community in Africa. So, you know, that's the issue for me. But I think that what's so strongly positive about food safety now is that what's being recognized is that food safety, which has been recently documented by the WHO as a big public health issue in Africa. We've known it all along, but they've quantified it. And in fact, on a per capita basis, Africa has the greatest burden of foodborne illness of any region in the world. So it's important for public health, but it is also important for trade and development. And so you've got the agriculture and trade agencies that are focused on economic development and being very focused on food safety, because there's this alignment between public health, you know, consumer-oriented public health goals and trade and development goals. And in Africa, those are naturally sort of overlapping, because the continent does need so much the ability to have a food system that can be successful both within local communities and also within the region and export markets, you know, in order to address basic food security needs. So economics and food security and food safety are really tied up together, and I think strongly aligned in Africa in a way quite different from the United States, where they are intertwined, but, you know, we're not dealing with the same kind of basic food security challenges that exist in Africa.
Sure. It sounds like a lot of it boils down to lack of infrastructure. If you don't have potable water, if you don't have ways to transport food before it goes bad, that those confound the issues even more.
Those are huge issues, of course. You know, people in their daily lives work around those issues in terms of the way they prepare food in the home. And, you know, 80% of the milk in, you know, sold in Kenya is through informal markets. It's not pasteurized, but then most people boil it before they consume it. Mm-hmm. So people work around that. But clearly, if there's going to be as Africa urbanizes, as supermarkets continue to be in a, you know, the modern supermarket chain sense, continue to be part of the food system, a growing part of the food system and consumer interface in Africa, you know, there's going to be a need to be operating with more developed infrastructure and being able to meet you know, modern standards for food safety. So, yeah, the water infrastructure is crucial. Power, you know, the fact that electrical power in many areas is not reliable if you're in a food production setting, you know, that can sure. be a problem. So right. generators are part of the picture. So, yeah, those are big. Those are absolutely some of the challenges that are faced in Africa and that need strategic investment, along with focusing on the more specific sort of food safety training and development of processes and interventions that are relevant to African hazards, the development of verification certification systems that can work in Africa. It's the whole mix of issues that go into food right. safety. All of them remain sort of challenges in many parts of Africa.
Well, sounds like you have a lot of work to do down the road then.
Well, I, you know, this project that I'm doing is mapping, doing this with the Global Food Safety Partnership at the World Bank, mapping the current donor activity and some of the significant industry activities around food safety capacity building in Africa. I'm doing more learning than I'll be delivering wisdom, I'm sure. You know, but there is a wide interest in our work at the African Union and in the development agencies because the community knows that this effort needs to be more targeted, you know, more strategic, more public-private collaboration, and we're hoping to just provide a resource, information resource that can help catalyze that.
Well, I'd like to offer Food Safety Magazine as a way to help disseminate that information when you have you know, a more comprehensive story to tell on that.
Yeah. Very good. Absolutely.
Now, you're also an advisor to the Food and Society program at the Aspen Institute, which, you know, when I looked that up, tremendously impressive board there. So what food programs are of the highest interest for the Institute, and what impact do you think they will have?
So that's a very an informal sort of advisory role to a program that's new, actually, that's run by a guy named Corby Kummer, who's a well-known food writer, very smart guy, who's starting that program. And my role has really been just to provide some ideas for activities they might undertake. You know, Aspen has this incredibly strong convening power to bring people together at a high level to figure out solutions to problems and in the food system. And so, you know, they've been we've been discussing, you know, some of the topics that they could address. I mean, one of them is looking at actually the debate around gene editing as the next generation of food. Of gene technology, and I, you know, I personally believe that there is a need to, you know, for the food industry, which was really left holding the bag in many ways, for the distrust issues, lack of consumer confidence issues, you know, spawned by the biotech acceptance controversy 20 years ago, the food industry needs to figure out how it wants this next wave of gene technology to be managed. You know, what are the applications of it that consumers can actually see as beneficial?
Right.
You know, what are the, you know, how should this technology be overseen from a regulatory standpoint? Right now, it's all voluntary that companies submit any information to FDA about gene technology. That's just the way the food additive law is structured, always subject to FDA objecting after the fact. There's been a biotech notification program for the original gene, you know, transgenic crops that came in, and that's worked well. I think everybody agrees, and because it's been a small number of companies coming in with, you know, very finite set of traits that are being marketed, but we now have a technology that can transform the genome in a much more efficient way, much less difficult technologically. Many people are likely to be doing this for many more different purposes. Potential exists to transform the food supply genetically. What's the right oversight? Should that all be done without, you know, just on a purely voluntary basis in terms of any interaction with FDA? I think there are some circumstances in which there should be mandatory notification at least. So anyway, those are the kinds of issues that you know, I think Aspen wants to figure out how it can be helpful in bringing people together to address. So, so that's, you know, this is something that I had good friends at Aspen, coming out of the government, and it was an easy thing for me to agree to just kibitz with them a bit.
I look forward to seeing, you know, what target programs they take on. That'll be really interesting.
Yeah.
You know, you joined the board of Stop Foodborne Illness, and I imagine with your background at FDA and USDA that allows you to help drive changes in national food policy to which this organization contributes. So what are some of the current policies that STOP is hoping to change?
Well, actually, the focus that I have in joining the board, and I joined at the same time that Jillian Keller from Wegmans joined, was really not so much on the regulatory policy front, although my guess is STOP will be, if and when there's a debate about meat and poultry legislative reform, I think STOP will have something to say about it, since STOP was born in the wake of the Jack in the Box outbreak, and so, but STOP has done work over the last several years that I've observed from outside. Around the topic of food safety culture and how STOP can, with the voice of people who've been affected by foodborne illness, help companies who are looking to strengthen their food safety programs and strengthen their food safety culture. You know, how can STOP help those companies answer the why question, you know, for their employees. Right. Why does it matter that we that you do the things we're training you to do in, you know, your food safety work? And so STOP has done some of this over the years in terms of giving talks to company meetings and doing videos. And there was one fabulous example of this sort of collaboration. It was a training video done, I think, in 2014 with the Leafy Green Marketing Agreement folks out in California, where two young women who had been injured severely as teens were invited out to tour the fields, learn about the food safety programs that the LGMA has done, which have, you know, been really important for improving produce safety, you know, before FSMA came along.
Sure.
And they taped a video that the industry asked them to do to tell their stories that would then be used in training materials and videos for field workers. So think about the difference in where we are from 25 years ago, when everybody was pointing fingers at everybody and saying it was the other guy's fault, and it was a very conflict ridden issue around food right. safety, to now we've got alignment around the importance of getting it right, the importance of implementing modern controls, and now increasing recognition that food safety culture, meaning a deep understanding on the part of everybody in the company of why food safety is a central value and needs to be done right every day. You know, with that sort of focus, how does a group like STOP contribute to that? I mean, and improve food safety by engaging companies that are wanting to be in this continuous improvement, strengthening food safety culture mode. So that's where I think there's an opportunity for STOP to, you know, continue to be a voice for consumers, and particularly the community directly affected by illness, on things like policy, public policy, regulatory policy. But really, we're at the mode where the question is not so much what's the policy, but how do we implement it effectively? You know, how do right. we actually do what we know now we should be doing and what the law requires? How do we actually operationalize that in a continuous improvement way? And that's where I think, you know, we're going to be exploring ways that STOP can work with the private sector and other organizations to try to help drive food safety culture strengthening in the country.
Right. Over the past year and continuing through the end of 2017, we've been covering every issue, a different part of the supply chain with regard to food safety culture. And I've been working with Jillian and Lone Jesperson on that series. Yep. So recognizing that it is a critical part that we need to be focusing on. So,
yeah.
You know, Mike, as we wrap up today, you know, kind of look into your crystal ball. What projects can you see yourself working on 5 years from now?
5 years from now. at some point, I would like to go to more Washington Nationals baseball games. But that's a mirage out there. No, listen, I am attracted to this whole amazing food system we have on our planet and how it meets people's needs. And you know, I imagine I'll continue to be working in the domains that we've been talking about, because that's where I built up a little bit of experience and a feeling that we are at a time when things are changing so much for the better. It, you know, still many, many dynamic challenges and you know, huge issues. But again, if you compare where we are now with where we were 25 years ago, it's you know, we're at a time when you know, a lot of good stuff is happening. And I think if we keep working together and find the ways that you can identify the alignment and then build on the alignment, you know, whether it's food safety culture in a U.S. setting or the synergy between investments in food safety and public health and economic development in Africa, you know, it's pretty attractive. So I don't have that great a crystal ball, but you know, these are issues that will be occupying many, many people for a long time still to come, particularly, you know, Africa. You know, these are decades long challenges to really right. build the system, but you know, hope to keep being involved.
That's great. Well, Mike, certainly you've taken time out of your incredibly busy schedule to join us on the podcast, and it's really been a tremendous privilege to speak with you today.
It's been my pleasure, Barbara, and look forward to talking again soon, I hope.
Great. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Mike Taylor for spending time with us and for all of his service during such important times for food safety. We look forward to keeping up with Mike as he continues his work with food security and the Aspen Institute. A special thanks to our presenting sponsor, Safety Chain Software. For more information on their food safety and quality management solutions, visit our show notes page or safetychain.com. To find links to references in this episode, visit our show notes page at foodsafetymagazine.com/podcast episode 10. Episode 10! Oh my God, a lot has gone into getting this far. Have you listened to all the great interviews that we've already presented? It's never too late to catch up. And why not make sure that you get each new episode as it's produced? You can do that by subscribing to Food Safety Matters. Write a review or send us an email at podcast@foodsafetymagazine.com with any comments. You know, we've gotten a couple of emails and another review since our last episode. Thanks so much for your feedback. It's very important to us. Keep it coming. All right, that's it for us today. Our next episode will post on October 10th. We'll talk to you then.